Mental health and mental fitness, what's the difference between those?
You're only mentally fit if you're actively training the brain. So mental fitness is the active maintenance of good mental health. Everyone is probably visualizing already. Most people visualize the worst case scenarios. So that's what we're getting good at. We're getting good at wiring the brain to think we can't make it. You know, I'd wake up having about 65 tablets in the morning. I'm going to the loo maybe 30 times a day and it's just pure blood. And I had an accident in front of everyone. So this is like 400 people. That moment scarred me. I was like, I am never, ever going to speak in public again.
What about just action?
I was in Oxford Circus on a bench and I was just doing my visualization. So obviously my eyes are closed, headphones in, kind of dangerous to be fair. People are looking at me so weirdly. Like, what's she doing? Oh, that's really embarrassing. But why can we run in public and we're not allowed to train our mind in public? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And so I think if we can start that young, that will change a lot. So questions, even just one question. Two, I'd say start changing the conversation around training the mind and body. And then three,
Maya, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
Thank you for being here. We're excited. So we kick off the same way we do every time. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
So my name is Maya. So I'm the UK's leading mental fitness and visualization experts, really helping people think, feel, perform like the top 1%. And in terms of what problem I solve, I think if we really take it back for a second, we all grew up, you know, doing PE class or knowing that training the body is important, but barely anyone knows how to actually train the mind to their advantage. And so that's what I really help people do.
Nice. And people that are watching this, what symptoms might they be facing that you can help them with?
So I think this in itself is interesting because I'm going to challenge you on that question.
Please.
Let's say if I was like a PT, would we say like, oh, well, you know, do you have to be fat or injured or, you know, unhappy to go to the gym? No. So I think the word symptoms is interesting because whilst, yes, you know, we all struggle with things like confidence or like imposter syndrome or anything like that. Really, I think it's also about going from good to great. Like nothing has to be wrong. You could be doing great in life and you could be like a world champion, yet you still need to learn how to train your mind so you can stay there or you can get better if it's even like 0.1%. So I think what I am really passionate about is making sure that we learn about it in the sense of you can be struggling and this can help you, but also you can be doing great and this can also help you. That's how I like to think about the mind.
Interesting. I want to clarify something you said up top because I think this will be important for people who've probably just tuned in. Mental health and mental fitness, what's the difference between those two?
Yeah, so there is a difference between mental health and mental fitness. So mental health, everyone has one. If you've got a mind, you've got mental health, right? Just like if you've got a body, you've got physical health. But you're only physically fit if you are, let's say, going to the gym, maybe you're running, doing Pilates. And in the same way, you're only mentally fit if you're actively training the brain. So mental fitness is the active maintenance of good mental health. But what I will say is that you've also got mental illness. Now, mental illness is where, let's say, your mental health is so bad that you would then seek professional health or, you know, get medication, etc. And then you have mental weakness. Now, mental weakness is something all of us will experience, right? Sometimes, you know, days you're just not as sharp or you're tired or something's happened in life, which just means your resilience is a bit lower. That is where your mental fitness is key because it gives you the tools to bring up your mental fitness again. So really, I see it as mental health, mental fitness, mental illness and mental weakness. And knowing that distinction is very important because then how you actually approach your own mind will also change. But what I will say is I kind of made up the term. Like the only other person I've heard talk about it is Simon Sinek. Other than that, it's really, you know, it was written in literature in like the 1980s, but no one really knows about it. In fact, it was interesting. I went, I did like, you know, those interviews in London and I was like to people, oh, rate your mental fitness 1 out of 10. And people were like, what is that? And I was like, okay, it's kind of obvious, but actually people didn't know. But since talking about it more, what I find is people find it more exciting, more empowering, kind of like sexy, you know, like, cool, I want to get mentally fit. It's attractive, rather than just being like, okay, let me just talk about my mental health. So the little distinction, I think, makes a lot of difference.
Okay, so then if we took the analogy of an athlete,
yeah.
So you know there's some people who are the child prodigy, I've got just inbuilt stamina, I can just run all day, or I'm naturally a very strong person. When we look at mental fitness, are there people who have more of a propensity to be fit in certain areas?
Yeah, I think naturally, you know, it comes from how we grew up, or the people we're around, or even your life experiences. But I think the key to remember is that at any point in your life, whether you are 80 or you are 18, you can improve your mental fitness. And that's great. So whether you are like, you know, super resilient or super confident, it doesn't really matter. Either it's about maintaining that, or there's always going to be parts of our brain and our life that we can improve. So yes, naturally you might be more stronger in areas, but that doesn't mean to say that we don't keep working on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that comes down to the self-awareness point of like, do you know what your mind is like? Do you know it enough to be like, actually, you know, I can handle my emotions really well, or I'm okay to say that I'm angry at something. I don't need to suppress it. All of these things are really important when it comes to actually building your mental fitness. It has to start with that awareness piece.
So people listening to this are maybe thinking, oh, I actually don't know how self-aware I am, or they're yeah. questioning it, or they've seen something on social media and they're like, I'm going to look into this. What questions should they be asking themselves to find out about their awareness?
That is a really good question. So self-awareness is, I think the way to frame it is like, you know how if we become friends with someone, or you go on a date with someone, or you're in a relationship, you know how you get to know them and you ask them things like, well, what do you like? Or what do you believe in? Or things like that. In the same way, do that for yourself. So some of the questions I would look at is like, what are your values? What are the things that make you feel alive? What are the things that actually drain you? Little questions like that will help you understand, actually, I don't like being in this environment, or I don't really like being around these people. But you know what? Like when I am surfing, let's say, I love it. Or when I am having an intellectual chat with someone, I also love it. So definitely your likes, dislikes, the things that drain you, energize you, really important. If you also want to build self-awareness, I would also ask quite difficult questions. I would ask yourself, you know, what part of me am I hiding because I'm afraid for others to see?
Mm.
Or why am I still performing in these environments? Or genuinely, do I like myself? One of the best questions to ask is, when I'm on my own, how do I feel about myself? And a lot of people will be quite scared to answer those questions because, one, we're never taught to, but two, it's quite, you know, like, oh gosh, you have to finally face some things. But it has to start there, because otherwise, without that, you won't know, you know, where to look or what to work on. So those are definitely some ones. And then also self-awareness is also about like, well, okay, in the last like year or few months, how have I changed the most? Because if you're just the same person like a year ago, I think that's a red flag.
Mm.
We've got to be constantly evolving and changing. That's really, really good. And so just asking that thing of like, okay, well, where was I a year ago? Where am I today? And then the question I always ask myself is, what do I still need to let go of? What am I holding on to that's stopping me from achieving my goals or becoming the person I want to be? Again, hard question, but such a great starting point.
I love that. I'm getting fired up already. Here we go. So when you were talking about fitness, it makes me think, and I'm going to chuck it out, of couch to 5K. Okay, so I'm a beginner. I've never done a 5K before, but the couch to 5K, it gets you moving slowly. If we think about mental fitness, I want this to be so actionable for people to take bits away. Where do they start?
Yes, okay, great question. So if you want to build your mental fitness, I would think of it as these five key areas. So one, you've got to be consistent, right? Even if that's like a few minutes a day, you want to do that. Two, let's look at diet. Now, diet isn't the food you eat. It's like what you consume. What does your mind consume? So a really actionable point is if you want to clean your mental diet, I would go on your social media and I would unfollow any account or person that just does not serve you. You know, people say to me like, oh, Maya, like I get online and then I'm just comparing myself to this person or that person. And they can literally be friends. They can be people who are doing such good in the world. But if it is affecting your mind, just get rid of it. Why are you putting yourself through that torture? So I kind of call it like a bit of a mental diet audit. Get rid of the things that you're consuming that you don't need. And that includes the things you watch. It includes the conversations you have. And two of the most common things humans do that genuinely like destroy mental performance, gossiping, complaining. If you can catch yourself when you're doing those things and just reduce it, think about what else you could fill your mind with. Ideas, inspirations, thoughts, debates. It's so much better. So diet is something very actionable and you can do today. Like just unfollow people or block people. You don't need that to be always like consuming it. The third thing is cardio. You know, your brain it's a tool that if you don't use it, it will just die. But generally, most of us are using it. If you're going to work, you're thinking, you're practicing. But if you want to take that further, think about pushing yourself, whether that's quizzes, whether that's questions like we just mentioned, whether that's having a debate with someone and actually like disagreeing with them. All of that expands your brain. The fourth thing, rest. You know, if you are someone who you go to bed and you wake up and you're still tired, you don't need physical rest. You clearly need mental and emotional rest. And that doesn't mean sitting on your bed, on your phone, watching TV and you think you're doing that. No, this really means giving your mind a break. Actually giving your mind the space to just be. And that might include things like meditation. It might include just like brain dumping all the stuff that's there. But really just creating pockets of space is important. And then the last one, which is, well, my absolute favorite, is the strength training. So I think where people, we lack education is how do I actually build a stronger mind? And for that, it's where I use visualization. So this is a tool that can completely rewire the brain. And so you're not just becoming aware of, you know, your characteristics and how it works, you're changing it. And so that might mean overcoming beliefs. It might mean becoming more confident. It might mean performing like better than ever, doing a sales call better than you've ever done, or handling a rejection much better. So that's where the visualization piece comes in. And I'd say the first step, if you want to try visualization, would be to focus on character visualization. Because when you start practicing identity changes, a lot can change like around you. So what I would suggest is spend maybe 5 minutes, close your eyes and ask yourself, if I was 1%, 2% more confident or more kind or more driven, who would I be? And in your visualization, you practice that, like see how you would walk, how you talk, how you might respond in an argument, like actually practice it and then open your eyes and do this repeatedly and you'll start seeing changes in your daily life and character.
Nice. That leads nicely on, actually. It's almost like you know where we're going with this. Visualization versus manifestation. What's the difference between those two?
So, yeah, visualization and manifestation are not the same things. So manifestation is really this idea that if you can create something in your mind, you know, you can make it happen. And I do believe in it. I really do. But visualization is a neurological mental training technique. Now, it's different for two reasons. One, because there are actually 5 techniques. So sometimes if I'm working with people, you know, we might do a creative visualization, which is to manage emotions. Is that manifestation? No. You are using mental imagery to feel and release an emotion. Now, where the slight overlap comes is when we're using visualization for achieving goals. And, you know, the manifestation, I guess, like arena is like, okay, if you see your goal, it will happen. Like, no, it's more that if you are wiring your brain for success, then sure, you might achieve your goal quicker, or you might see opportunities you never would have. But I always like to compare it to like Michael Phelps. You know, he visualized his goals all the time. Would we ever say that he manifested 26 golden medals? We wouldn't say that. And I think in the same way, it really comes down to how you frame a technique will change how you use it. So you might notice everyone manifests at like the beginning of the year and then they never go back to it, right? They do their vision board and that's cool. Okay, I've manifested this. I'm now just going to stop. That's not what we're trying to do here. Mental fitness and specifically visualization is something you want to do at least 3 times a week, because think about how often your brain will go back to that same, you know, old patterns or old ways of performing. So it's something we've got to keep doing. And really, I've learned everything from the sports world, and none of them will talk about it as manifestation, right? They talk about it as mental imagery. I'm training my mind and I'm wiring myself for success. And in part, if sure, you manifest different things through your goals, that's great. But the other techniques don't have anything to do with manifestation.
Interesting. Okay. So 3 times a week. So let's say someone is listening to this who they've got a goal of, I want to move house. That's where I want to be at the end of the year. How do they visualize getting there? Is it about visualizing the steps it takes to get there? Is it about what the smell is like in the house? Like, well, what are they actually doing 3 times a week?
So I'd say you want the one non-negotiable, which is actually seeing yourself in the new house, because you cannot be what you can't see, right? So actually seeing yourself enjoying it, being there, and that creates resilience as well, because let's say houses fall through or you don't get there. If you have this laser focused vision that, you know what, I'm going to make it, that is very rare and it's such an advantage. So that's one aspect of it. Two, it is the process. If you are someone who needs more organization or you want to like actually see yourself taking those steps to get there, then you would do a type of process visualization where you're seeing, you know, you're mentally rehearsing, okay, I need to do X, Y, Z to get there. But it really depends on your brain, right? If you're inspired by just seeing yourself at that end point, just go for that. You just need that inspiration to keep going. And you want to do that, yeah, like 2-3 times a week. And you'll at least become more resilient and have more belief that you're going to make it happen.
When I bought my house, we didn't know if it was going to go through in the last minute. And I was saying to my partner, pack for the house you want, not the house that you have.
Oh, I love that.
So we packed and we hoped that it went through. And it did. So yeah. Visualization might have come into that. When you're working with clients, what do you find that they typically get wrong about visualization?
I think there are many misconceptions with visualization. One is obviously the more woo-woo like manifestation thing, which we've obviously spoken about. Two is actually they underestimate it a lot. They really do. And I think a lot of people think they don't have time for it. Whereas I'm very much an advocate for like, I'm not asking you to spend hours on this a day. I'm literally asking for maybe 4 to 5 minutes at least. Like anyone can do that when you're on the train, when you're, you know, just in your bed in the morning. Like, I think that's an excuse. And I'm very strict at the beginning to be like, if you're not even going to be willing to invest that, there's no point working together. Because you've got to take your mental fitness as a lifelong journey and skill. And I'd say that's the third point, is that I always teach visualization as a skill. Because if you see it as a skill, just like, you know, playing the piano or weightlifting, you'll be more invested in knowing that it's okay to not get it right at first, or it's okay to maybe not have the best experience. It's something you've got to keep improving. So really it comes down to the education piece. But ultimately, I think the biggest way of convincing someone about visualization is just do it, try it. Like, it's like, imagine if we just sat on this podcast and just spoke about how good running was. Okay. But like, you'll only really know if you do it, right? You just got to go on the run, and then you can decide, actually, you know what? I feel good. And the more you do it, yeah, I'm getting better and I'm seeing progress. I'm seeing, I'm fitter, all of that. Same way. Like, I'm so done talking about mental fitness or mental health. Like, I'd rather someone watching this or listening to this, as soon as you finish, go and try one of the things we've said and actually commit to it. That's what's going to make the difference.
So I'm sure that your mental fitness throughout the years has kind of built up and this resilience. I guess for when you go back to the beginning, what has changed from when you first started visualization to kind of where you are now?
So I think my journey with visualization was quite different to how others would kind of enter it. I mean, I started learning about visualization in hospital. So for me, it was a a chance to relearn how to walk again, to manage pain, but also to just see myself being healthy again. So it was very much like, at that point, I was in like rock bottom, and visualization was a massive source of hope. At that point, it wasn't, I didn't realize it was a training tool. I saw it as just like, actually, this is giving my mind new possibilities. Then once I trained with, you know, neuroscientists and athletes and even their coaches, that's when I really realized that, wow, this has a lot more power and scope than I ever knew. But here's where it gets really interesting. So when I first started learning about it, it was very much outcome process. Creative visualization, I really learned from, you know, I learned from neuroscientists like David Hamilton and Louise Hay, who really spoke about creative visualization as a tool for the body and emotions and disease. Then explorative visualization, which is so undocumented, was found in like Walt Disney and Einstein's journals. So when I was reading this, I was like, whoa, like this is obviously a visualization, but no one has put it as one of those skills. And so I guess through my learning and through my research, I realized that it's such a versatile skill that whilst, yes, I used it to overcome an illness, now I use it to become the leading expert in my field, or to captivate people when I'm public speaking, or to see, okay, what does the Nike of mental fitness look like? Like, that's how I'm using it now. And so honestly, I just fell more in love with it, because not only was I experiencing the benefits of it, I was also understanding who else in history has been using it. We just never knew. And that's kind of exciting. It feels like a little bit of a superpower in some ways, but yet all of us are doing it. And you know what's really interesting? Everyone is probably visualizing already. Most people visualize the worst case scenarios. So they'll be seeing like, oh, but what if this goes wrong? What if I go blank on stage? Or what if I don't make this deal? What if I fail at my business? That's what we are rehearsing. So that's what we're getting good at. We're getting good at wiring the brain to think we can't make it. But we don't realize we're doing it.
Interesting. Are you able to tell us about the medical issue?
Yeah, of course. So I was very high performing when I was young. I guess what you call like a high achiever. Also, I'm South Asian, right? So if you didn't get A stars, you were out the family. But there was that expectation pressure, but I thrived under it because I was living up to it. And I also played badminton for county, and you know, my hopes was going for country and then, you know, maybe even Olympics. And then at 15, I was diagnosed with a condition called ulcerative colitis. So some people know what Crohn's is, but basically it's an inflammatory bowel disease, but it's incurable. So as soon as I was diagnosed, that was the only word I kept getting told, is that unfortunately there is no solution. You can manage it with medication, but it's an incurable disease. And just imagine, like, you're 15. What are you meant to do with that? But I was actually very positive. I was an optimistic young girl. So I kind of just took it on my chin and carried on with life. But I guess I didn't really realize the reality of the disease at all. And so as time went on, it just got worse and worse and worse. And so, you know, I sometimes don't know how to explain to people what life was really like, but take a day, you know, I'd wake up, I'm having about 65 tablets in the morning. I'm going to the loo maybe 30 times a day, and it's just pure blood. And of course, along with that, there is so much physical pain. Oh, it's like animalistic. You know, you're so paralyzed by it that nothing can help. Not even crying or screaming does anything, because you're just so frozen by it. But then, of course, the mental aspect of this was just harrowing, because everything that I think makes us human, I lost. It was connection. It was the ability to just walk, the ability to go to the loo. Like, we all take it for granted. I was wearing nappies. Like, it was so shameful to be 17, 18 and just feeling like so dehumanized. And of course, lost my friends. I just became a bit of a shell in who I was. And well, truthfully, I didn't really see much point in trying because I'd given everything to overcoming this disease. Everything, you know, went from like every diet under the sun. I was drinking celery juice, liters of it a day. I went to France, India, America to try and find the best doctors. Fecal transplants, which weren't even legal in the country, but you do. You're so desperate, right? You're so desperate to get better. And you know, I can obviously sit here today being so grateful that it is a disease I have genuinely overcome, and I have no fear about that. But can I pinpoint it on like one particular thing? No, I think there's always going to be a combination of whether it's diet, lifestyle, people, etc. But one thing I will definitely say is that the mind is just the most powerful part of us. Like when you can become so, I guess, strong and resilient and have the belief that you can make something happen, I truly believe the mind is capable of just anything. And that is something, yeah, I fully believe. Whatever that looks like for people. And yeah, for me, it was, you know, really honing in on visualization and training myself and training those beliefs away. Even the belief like you'll be sick forever. That can be so damaging for a girl, right? So damaging for anyone. So I had to rewire that. I had to see a different possibility. And again, you can only be what you can see. And so I really took that to heart, basically.
Well, what's an example then in that journey of a story that you held or a belief that you held that you rewired and saw immediate results from doing that?
I guess immediate, it's never, I guess nothing's going to be immediate. I think, actually, I do have one. So when I went to uni, I did eventually, I was able to go after I'd, you know, got a little bit better. You know, I mentioned I used to be very confident as an individual, and I loved, I was very bubbly. I would always be like the first to ask questions, etc. So in uni, I remember being in a lecture hall and we all had to do presentations. This was for our like final marks. And I was initially excited, but I was so nervous because it was the first one I'd done for a long time. And I was up in front of everyone. And I just knew what was about to happen. I was literally having an accident. So with colitis, you can't control when you go to the loo, so you have to like run. Obviously, I'm doing a presentation. It was so humiliating, the whole thing. And I had an accident in front of everyone. So this is like 400 people. Obviously, no one knew, which I think was the hard of it, because you're just standing there. You've literally, like, you feel awful. Luckily, I was wearing a nappy. But I remember that moment scarred me. I was like, I am never, ever going to speak in public again. Never, because that's going to happen. And the interesting thing about the brain is when an experience is super emotional, it becomes very wired very quickly. It becomes so like stuck in your brain. And so any opportunity to do any presentations or anything, I just said no. I was like, I can't do that. I literally can't do that. I'm going to have an accident. So the association was anytime I speak in public or in front of someone, I'll have an accident. And it happened a few times. So I was like, Maya, you need to break this pattern. That's just not, like, you can't go on like that. So I did two things. One, I used process visualization to see myself in different environments, public speaking, but not having an accident. So I was showing my brain that actually when you do this activity, this is how it can go. I was creating a new road in my brain. But then the other thing I did was negative visualization. So I would see myself having an accident in front of people, but I would show my brain that I was fearless when it happened. And I would show my brain that it's okay and that I would respond differently. So what that did is it took away the fear of it ever happening again. And I genuinely was like, I don't care. Genuinely, even if it happened now, I wouldn't give a shit. Am I allowed to swear? Sorry if not. But like, I just wouldn't care. I don't have that fear anymore. But at the same time, I have so much trust in my performance that like my brain was able to rewire. And now what? I'm speaking on stages in front of thousands of people and it's my job. So I've seen such a difference in that belief, that performance and that growth.
I love that. And this is where it gets fascinating for me. I think it's the positive, but also the negative. So we go back to what you said before, and people are probably, and I was definitely, look back a decade, laying in bed at night, and you're probably worrying about the worst things that yes. that are going to happen. So what if people are doing that and they're getting visualization wrong, how do they flip that? What are some of the most common patterns that you see, and how do you help break them?
Okay, so a very, very simple one that all of us can just take today is if you catch yourself saying, okay, well, what if this goes wrong? What if I get really anxious? Or what if these people judge me? What if they think it's really embarrassing? Just pause and ask yourself, okay, but what if it worked out? What if it went better than I thought? What if actually I did really well and I tried my best? So even that one shift is going to help you in the moment. Now, when it comes to the visualization, see, sometimes negative visualization can actually be really helpful for people. And I'll give you an example. Let's say you're trying to stop a really bad habit, maybe smoking. What they found is that the research shows that if you visualize, like, let's say you continue to smoke for 10 years and you visualize what that would do to your life, your family, the fear of that actually motivates people to stop the habit. However, some people don't respond to it. Some people will respond to see yourself living without smoking, being really healthy, being really active, and that motivates them more. So sometimes we can be motivated by fear. Sometimes we can be motivated by the pull of a vision. So if you know that you are generally visualizing like those images that don't help you, I think start just simply closing the eyes and going with that prompt of the question, what if it did work out better, and actually see a better possibility. And that can be in any scenario. It can be in business, it can be in personal life, it can be in sports, whatever it is. Especially with your goals, if you can show your brain that I can do this, you are going to give yourself a much better chance of making it happen. Because, you know, the thing I've noticed is that working with like some of the best champions and entrepreneurs and CEOs in the world, you're like, what is it? What is it that gives you that edge that is the reason you're here today? And do you know what they all say? I believed in myself. It doesn't matter about your skill, your talent. At the end of the day, if you have that belief that you're going to make it happen, like, it gives you the mental edge. And there are very, very few things that are more important than the attitude of, I will make this happen. No matter how long, what it's going to take, yeah, I want this, I'm going to make it happen.
Nice. So this, I don't know if this will be challenging, so I'm excited to see where you, okay. where you take this, but what about the people that are thinking, so visualization is one way of doing it, but actually when you were talking there, I was thinking, well, what about just action? If I can say, right, I'm actually going to just keep going on stage and giving myself the evidence, so I've actually got concrete evidence rather than visualizing it, because then that's real, that's concrete evidence. What would you say to those people?
So I get a lot of people come to me to be like, well, you know, let's say it's public speaking or fear of that, right? Apparently, did you know fear of public speaking is more than the fear of death? Yeah.
Wow.
People literally feel it's like dying. So, okay, if I put you on stage and I said, do this 100 times, right? You will naturally get better at public speaking, right? Mm-hmm. You'll probably be less anxious and you would have done it. Problem is, one, we don't all have the time for that. Two, your doubts, past experiences and fears are going to get in the way. You will self-sabotage very quickly. And it will just mean that the experience is either so traumatic that you're adding to it, or that you just won't take action. Now, this is where it's powerful. Why can we use visualization here? So I would then suggest to you, we visualize maybe 60, 70 times you on all these different stages, speaking, walking on, doing well, getting results you want, and getting better each time. It works because as amazing and complex and incredible as your mind is, it's actually very, very simple. Because it really struggles to know the difference between you actually doing something and you just imagining it. So you going on stage, right, is going to fire these neurons in the brain. Now you visualizing going on stage, it fires nearly identical neurons in the brain. So by us visualizing it beforehand, we're getting you better, getting your performance better, getting your beliefs stronger before you even step on there. And that's why it's good, because we don't all have the time to just physically practice. And take like F1, really good example. They literally can't be in the car all the time because of the G-force, right? Same with like bobsledders. They can't do it. That's why when you utilize something like visualization, you're still upskilling and getting your technique better or your beliefs better, even though you're not physically doing it. And so in the same way, why don't we use the same situation? Mm. That's what I would say.
Like it.
What's the role of consistency? So if we're thinking of visualization and mental fitness, is it right now it's a habit and I have to do it 3 times a week, like you said before, or once it becomes part of you, do you change the habit?
Yeah, so I think, look, there are so many different ideas and thoughts about habits, right? The really important thing to remember about the brain is that it moves towards what it's most familiar with. And that's why, rather than even talking about it in a habit sense, all I would say is think about repetition. Your brain thrives under repetition. Let me do that again. Your brain thrives with repetition. So for most of us, if you have been repeating, you know, doubts or fears or I'm not good enough or I'll never build this business or I'm just not a good salesperson, if that's what you've been repeating for so long, that's what your brain is good at. It's what it's familiar with. So it will give you every possible evidence and opportunity and reason to tell yourself, okay, this is true. Now, by repeating a different thing, what you're going to be doing is making your brain familiar with a new possibility or a new belief. Now, if you do that once, great. You might fire some new neurons, but then it will go away because your old road comes into play again. So with the brain, by repeating it again and again and again, and look, I'm not saying it needs to be for years. You know, the brain can rewire in like 90 days. And so you'll start seeing those changes already, but that's how you actually start to change the structure of those beliefs and your brain. So really it comes down to repetition. So what I say is, it's more effective to do 2 minutes of visualization a day than 1 hour at the beginning of the week.
Hmm.
Like absolutely. Or even 30 seconds, 10 times a day. That's why I always, when people are trying to improve their self-talk, a really great way to rewire is every time, it's called the doorway method, comes from Michael Phelps. Every time you walk under a door, just say something that's actually going to serve you. Like, okay, I'm going to do this. Or I'm super grateful for this opportunity. Because think about how many doors you go under. You've probably been through, like 20 today already. Like, by that repetition, you're wiring your brain to just think better, think more positively, think like the top 1%. And it's as simple as that, repetition.
Wow. Jack's actually got a thing where you probably think the same thing.
Yeah, it was.
When it's like 10 past 10 or 11 minutes past 11, he always goes, life's good.
Yeah, I love it. I love that. That's so good.
And he shouts it to his team in the office as well.
That's so good.
Yeah, it's a powerful one. Sorry, mate, you were probably going to say that, weren't you? Got
that. But you can do it with anything. When you take a sip of water or as soon as you wake up. You know, I remember when I was like very ill, I hated waking up. Why would I want to, right? And then my own teacher was like to me, why don't you wake up and just say, thank you, show me how good it gets. And I was like, I can barely like move or breathe. Why would I say that? I've now done it for around 6 years. I don't even think about saying it and I say it. I open my eyes, my brain is immediately like, thank you, show me how good it gets. And it's just so cool how I've literally just built that habit and my brain automatically knows, say that immediately.
Wow. So I'm going to give you a personal example and just see what you think of this. So me and Jack, we've got another podcast about stoicism, right? So we talk about stoicism all the time.
Love Marcus.
Yes, we love a bit of Marcus. but sometimes my wife will definitely listen to this because she's a big fan, but she gets annoyed at me for like, I'm almost there's no reaction to most things. Actually that becomes quite annoying, and I get why that would be annoying, you know, if we're trying to get the kids out to school and stuff. So is there a point where you can kind of take it too far?
So I love stoicism and I understand the you know approach to it. I think this is again where it comes to, everyone is so different. Now I am not like that. I am a very emotional individual. And I don't mind that I react because I've learned how to respond or communicate how I'm reacting. So like if I feel anger or frustration or sadness, like I will feel it. And here's a good way of putting it, right? So look at two tennis players. You've got Jannik Sinner, who on court, you will never see an emotion from him, ever. He's very stoic. Whatever's happening in the game, you just, no, you don't see it. Take Djokovic. He will shout, he will cry, he will express, he will get angry, because that's what he needs. That's what his body and mind need. And as soon as he's done that, he's back on court ready to go. Now, if he suppressed that and just tried to just be like, no, like, you know, just look okay, look mature, he wouldn't play very well. So this is where it comes down to, once you learn what your emotions need and how much you feel things or how you need to express it, then of course, like, you know, for some people, stoicism is going to be really good. For others, no, they may need to be a little bit more energized with their reactions, and that's okay. But the key is being able to communicate that and understanding each other's language. That's very important. So I kind of get your wife, to be fair. Like, I'm, you know, one of my exes used to be very stoic, and I'd be like, I don't get it. How are you not angry at this? How are you not frustrated? But then I learned to honor that, like, that's how he deals with it. And that's amazing. And I definitely was inspired by it. Did it work for me? No, because I then harbored a lot more than I wanted to. And so it's really about learning that language and experimenting. That's key.
And then I know from social media, you work with some incredible clients all over the world. So you do some amazing work. One of the things that I'm thinking about now is, and the clear up between visualization and manifestation was brilliant, but picking yourself up. So if I was to visualize myself as more confident, more chatty, whatever, in those situations, that's probably not something that maybe is measurable. I can go out and say, yeah, I felt like that. But for the people that then visualize something and it might not come true, or actually it still goes wrong even though they visualized it, how do you help people to maybe pick themselves back up and get back on the horse if the work that they've done doesn't feel like it's paying off?
Yeah, I get this question a lot of like, well, Maya, what if I don't reach my goals? Or, you know, but it didn't turn out the way I wanted. I'm going to answer this in two ways. So I actually saw a clip really recently of Venus Williams talking about how she would use visualization before all the games. And she was like, it's not to say that, you know, every game turned out the way I wanted to. No. But did I give myself the best chance of doing that? Yes. And I like that. It's really about how you mentally preparing yourself. Because if you walk into a game or a room or a networking event or, you know, a sales call where you're thinking, oh no, like, oh, that person's good, or like they're not gonna agree or whatever, you're just already like ruining your chances, right? So one thing is, think of it more as the inputs you're putting. Mm-hmm. Second thing, it's just not about the goals, is it? It's not about, you know, really that end result. The thing I can genuinely say, whether I've achieved the goal or not that I visualized, or that confident person or whatever, I can honestly say who I have become on the way is worth it. Because if I was visualizing, let's say I'm visualizing the Nike of mental fitness, right? Which is exactly what I'm doing. I don't know if I'm going to get there. Who even knows what that is, right? But is it pushing me to be bolder with my conversations or with what I am trying to build? Yes. And I know that the person I'm becoming because of that visualization and that vision is a much stronger, much confident, you know, much more kind of brave individual. And so I always say to people, don't get too attached to the goal. Think about more like, who are you becoming on the way? That's what's exciting. Because, and I'll make it so real, I once worked with this woman called Katie, and she was building her own company. And she was like, okay, Maya, like, you know, it's the first launch. I want 5 clients. I was like, okay, cool. Why don't we visualize 50? Not to say that, right, we're going to attach to 50 and that needs to be our number. But you seeing that you're going to be working with 50 clients is undoubtedly going to make you think slightly differently. It's going to make you perform slightly differently. You're going to go on those calls and not be so scared that, like, oh my God, if I don't get this client, I'm, you know, not going to get my 5. No, you're going to be thinking, you know, 10, 20, 30, and you may even get 10, 20, 30 because you gave yourself 50. So what I find is it's such a great way to be impatient with your inputs but be very patient with your outputs. It's not about attaching to the goal. And as soon as someone says that to me, I'm like, that's just not the question we need to be asking. Same with how long will it take? However long it takes. If you want it, time won't matter.
Mm.
That's key.
Beautiful, beautiful answer. This is a selfish question.
Love it.
And hopefully some people can get something out of it. I've got a young son.
Yeah.
Just turned one. Zach's got four children. Mental fitness as they're growing up is going to be a thing.
Yes.
I feel that even the world with mental health these days. So I think when they're so young and so susceptible, how do we as parents influence, lead them to start thinking about their own mental fitness?
Yeah, so, you know, I do work with kids, and I think why I love it is maybe not as young as one just yet, but their imaginations are incredible, right? But as we get older, we tend to dampen that, and we tend to say, no, you can't be an astronaut, or like, you have to do this. So one thing I would say is always remind them how powerful their imagination is, because it really does start from here. The second thing is, with kids, I think questions are the most powerful thing you can ask. Because, you know, just imagine if you got into the habit of, just like how we teach them to brush their teeth, right? Dental hygiene. Imagine if every night before they went to bed, you simply asked them, what are you grateful for today? Cool. They're going to grow up just always doing that and then doing it to their kids. And it always reminds me of Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx. Mm-hmm. And she said that, you know, every day at dinner, her dad would ask them the question of, what did you fail at today? And she said that it just became a normal dinner question. And it meant that when she grew older, she celebrated a lot of her failures, and she now does it with her kids. So I think people underestimate how those traditions and habits, how quickly they can form. And so just like they brush their teeth, asking that one question. And really, I think the most important thing is, just like how when you're young, you know, I was put into every sport ever. And like, go try this, go try netball, go try gymnastics or whatever. At school, they're not going to be doing mental fitness. So it's our job at home or in other situations to just talk about training the mind. Just like how we train the body and they see you going to the gym, talk about it. Like, I find it interesting. So I was in Oxford Circus on a bench and I was just doing my visualization. So obviously my eyes are closed. Headphones in, kind of dangerous to be fair. And people are looking at me so weirdly. They're like, what's she doing? Oh, that's really embarrassing. But why can we run in public and we're not allowed to train our mind in public? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And so it's because I think culturally we've seen like only like monks and people on mountains doing this. I'm like, no, let's get it in the forefront of people's minds so that they realize actually it's a very cool thing to do. And so I think if we can start that young, that will change a lot. So questions, even just one question. Two, I'd say start changing the conversation around training the mind and body. And then three, never let them forget how powerful their imagination is, because those beliefs start from young, right? One thing a teacher says or one thing a parent says will start creating those roads in the brain that then show up when we're older. So we have a responsibility to plant the correct seeds and the correct roads, however young.
Nice. I've started recently when my son brings me a picture that he's drawn, asking him how he feels about it first so that he doesn't necessarily attach a validation that I need here. Almost like I really like this first, and he kind of talks me through it first. So he's just there to, if he's happy first, then we're all happy.
I love that. That's really good.
Yeah. So hopefully that's gonna work. That's gonna pay
fingers
off.
Fingers crossed.
I've picked up on something. So we love communication, mindset, neuroscience, all these different things. The way you speak is very certain. There's no ums, ahs, and I'm guessing that's something that you've worked on. But how important is that in the visualization piece, the kind of certainty in the language you're using?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting thing. Like, I have started replacing the word beliefs with certainty, because really, when you're creating a new belief, your reality may not reflect that just yet. You know, if I'm like, okay, I'm a great public speaker and I'm actually pretty crap, it's a bit like, whoa, what's going on? So I think the brain, like I said, you know, because it moves towards what it's familiar with, the more certain you are with something, then the easier it's going to be to adopt that. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, you know, even though, yes, I'm a mental fitness expert and, you know, I've done visualization for so many years, I still have days where my certainty like drops, or let's say I have doubts, or you know, I'm a bit fearful. Like, even take like the book, right? It's a really new professional challenge for me. I'm obviously very nervous. I'm really nervous. Like, yes, I've put in so much work into it, but you know, you never know what's going to happen. And there have been moments I'm like, oh no, you shouldn't publish this. Or like, no, 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 like people aren't going to like it. Of course that comes up for me. The point is, am I going to listen to it? Am I going to feed it even more? No. And that's what we can do, is that like those thoughts, it's not about never having negative thoughts or having doubts, right? Let them come in, enjoy them. The key is, what are you going to say to them? How are you going to respond to them? And I don't know if you've ever heard about this story about the, it's like a Cherokee legend about these two wolves. Yeah, yeah. And the granddad is like telling the grandson, okay, so in our mind, we have these two wolves that are kind of against each other. You've got the one that's very empowering, positive and certain. You've got the other one that's a bit more doubtful, self-sabotaging and negative. And he was like, well, they're always fighting each other in your brain. And the grandson is like, well, who wins? And the grandfather's like, it's the one you feed. And I love that, because it's not to say the wolf isn't there. Mm. It's the thing that you have control to be like, how certain are you going to be? What are you going to feed? And that, the one you feed is the one that's going to be more certain. You can absolutely hold, you know, doubt and courage in the same hand. Absolutely. The point is, which one are you going to make louder? And that's where I see certainty. So yeah, in the visualization piece, of course, you want to prompt and prime your brain to be like, this can be possible. And a really simple shift, so I actually spoke about this recently, is that when you're talking about your goals, instead of being like, I want to achieve XYZ, simply say, I am achieving. That tiny shift will completely change the way you look at it. That perspective is so important. Or even, you know how like Muhammad Ali would be like, I am the greatest. It's kind of interesting, right? He became the greatest. Like, he's just so certain that even if it didn't happen, the point is he was still going to get very far with it. And so, yeah, the words you say matter, and the way you say it matters even more. But I'll also challenge that and say, sometimes it's not about being assertive. Sometimes it's about being compassionate or kind, right? Because if we're always so like assertive to ourselves, sometimes the brain just needs a bit to be like, look, it's okay, chill, take the day off. You know, you made a mistake, it's okay. And sometimes that's what we need instead. So the tone does matter as well.
Beautiful, amazing. Can you tell us about the book?
Yeah, so the book is called Visualize. Think, Feel, Perform Like the Top 1%. So it's out March 27th. And, you know, did I ever think I'd be writing a book? No. But I did it because everything about visualization has been so, like, behind the scenes, there's been so much gatekeeping and so much lack of education that, yes, you have a few chapters here and there, but really there's nothing out there where you can apply it to your life. Now, you have a lot in old sports psychology, so books from like the 1900s, which I love, but it's all to do with sports. But like, you know, how does someone, let's say who's 20, how did they get better at networking? How does maybe a mum of four manage her anxiety? But how does also, yeah, like one of the top 10 tennis players win the Australian Open? So what I love about the book and how it's designed is anyone can take anything from it. And the way I've done it is it's awareness, intelligence, and then execution. Get aware, like the self-awareness piece. What is your brain like? You know, get to know it. Intelligence is all about the five types of visualizations and being able to practice that and do them. And then execution, like we spoke about, how do you actually integrate it into your life? Because if you can't really, you know, how many of us just read a book and then we never do anything about it? Mm. Yeah, been there, done that. We can't do that anymore. We've actually got to take steps. It's like reading a book about running, never running. I don't want that to happen. So that's why I made it as practical and easy to implement as possible. But yeah, I'm excited. I think it's going to be a lot of new information in this area, done in a quite different way as well, which will be fun to see how people can really take it and integrate it.
I'm so excited for you. This conversation has been inspirational and refreshing, Maya. So thank you for joining us. Obviously, we'll put a link to the book. But where else can people find you? Where should they find you? How can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so talk a lot on my Instagram. So that's maya.mentalfitness. That's good mental diet, by the way. Once I did that, someone was like, so should we just unfollow you? And I was like, savage. Or obviously LinkedIn, which is Maya Achora as well. And then, yeah, the book. And then, you know, I'm always hosting events in London and doing bits here and there because I think why not create a bit of a community around this, you know? We have so many in the physical fitness space. I think mental fitness deserves the same. So, and that's all on websites and on Instagram as well. So yeah, and I'm always up for a chat. I reply to all my DMs because I wish I had that when I was also learning about this because not a lot of people are talking about it. So yes, always up for a quick chat or a voice note. I'm a voice note kind of guy.
Love it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.